I remember a lot of the media at that time was focusing on the victims. I was like, no, the question is the police officers and what is their life experience? Do they have a friend who looks like Philando Castile?
Hey, welcome to In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, hosting solo this week, while my co-host Maria Hinojosa is on a reporting trip in El Paso. Joining me here in Boston is Farrah Stockman, reporter for the New York Times. Welcome back, Farrah.
Thanks for having me.
And also here with us in Boston is Marcela Garcia, editorial writer for the Boston Globe and co-host of the new weekend edition of WGBH's Boston Public Radio. Hello, Marcela.
Hi, Julio. Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have my Boston crew. Today we're focusing on different types of violence, right, that have occurred over the last week. And we're going to try to do this with this overarching question. When is violence just about the action? And when is it about the identity of the actor? All right, so let's start this conversation by turning to London. On Sunday night, a white man drove into a group of worshippers exiting a mosque after prayer.
One person is dead and eight were taken to the hospital after the attack, which is being investigated as suspected terrorism.
And on Twitter, J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter author, wrote this about the Daily Mail. The Mail has misspelled terrorist as white van driver. Now let's discuss how he was radicalized. So, Farrah, do you think Rowling is right to criticize the Daily Mail for not using the word terrorist?
Yes. I mean, I think that violence is always about the identity of the actor. Like, you know, if somebody murders 150 people at a wedding, if you're a U.S. soldier, that's different than if you're, a dude walking down the street.
Right.
And it means something different because people attribute your motives differently.
Accordingly, yeah. Really, the question is, you know, what can we glean from their motives and whether it was meant as an act of terror, whether it was meant to send a message, whether it was meant to sow fear, or whether it was just, in other words, did this person have a manifesto? Was it political violence? Was it meant to send a real message of fear? So I do agree with J.K. Rowling, because in the immediate aftermath, I think it was somewhat clear that it was really meant to sow and send this message of fear.
Well, and going back to the definition of terrorism, which is to target civilians. I mean,
right.
Were they civilians? And, you know, does it have a political point?
As of this taping, President Trump has yet to tweet about this. He's quick to tweet about a Manchester, but you don't see, like, you know, praying for the victims of the London mosque. I mean, what do you think?
Well,
as she looks at me, she's like, damn you, Varela.
First of all, talk about a London attack. You're like, which one?
I
mean,
I know,
we're starting
sad.
To get terrorism fatigue. So it is hard to compare a first attack with something that's happened later. But I expect this will get coverage for the very reason that we're covering it.
Last week, I was also thinking about the same question about we're talking about whether to focus on the action or the actor, right, when there's violence, right? And that's the question that our producer, Noam Hassenfeld, and myself, we've been talking about this for the last week. So I wanted to read this post from Sean King after Wednesday's shooting at the congressional baseball practice. And this is what he said. He goes, immediately, I began to see well-known white talking heads do something I never see them do when the shooter is a Muslim or black or an immigrant. They immediately began talking about what type of white man this man was. So, Marcela, Sean King's post, does that make any sense to you? Does it resonate?
I tend to agree with that, yeah. Unfortunately, when we cover these type of things, you go back to who's covering these things, right? And so you can't really ask this primarily white media to try to deconstruct an immigrant or try to deconstruct a black person, because they just don't have that context.
So you're saying it's because it's their world, so they can kind of talk to this, they understand this.
Perhaps.
63-year-old white man out of Illinois, as opposed to...
It fits into another narrative that they have, which is the narrative of violence on the left. The narrative, this person was clearly a Bernie supporter, and he was... it looks pretty clear he had political motives. Now, I'm not saying he wasn't mentally ill, so I think that they had another narrative to go to that is worth talking about, maybe. So I have to tell you that the day this happened, I was kind of riveted by hearing the experiences of these congressmen on the baseball field. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to them as I was getting dressed. And I was just like, this is a moment in America. Like, I didn't grow up with political assassinations being, the norm. And so it felt like a real moment to me. And I remember going to my Facebook page and there was just nothing. None of my friends posted about it. And nobody was saying anything. And I remember I remember thinking, what would this look like? What would my Facebook page look like if a Trump supporter had gone to shoot a bunch of Democratic lawmakers?
Did you think it was because he was immediately identified as a Bernie supporter and people were trying to rationalize?
People knew. I mean, there are a few things from reporters, and I started going into this guy's Facebook page myself. So I spent a good pair. This is the amazing.
Like digital reporting
101. This is the amazing part of American politics right now, is that you can look and see into the inner thoughts of a person who killed like 2 hours ago. You can see
almost immediately.
You can see what he was thinking like 5 months ago, 3 months ago, two months ago. Not only that, you can hear the responses because everybody came to his Facebook page. Lots of people started talking to him, this dead man, and saying things to him. That is fascinating. And it is unprecedented. But I put it out there in my Facebook page and I said, guys, what do we have? What, if anything, do we say about the fact that this guy was a Bernie supporter? Does it matter? How should we feel about this? What should we be saying about this? Because it personally, it breaks my heart that we're at this place in American politics right now. And there was surprisingly little empathy from my friends for this dude. I mean, he was a white supremacist, the victim. He was, he voted against gay marriage and was saved by a heroic black female cop who was gay. So, like, I get it. But it was just, it felt like a real moment to me. And I think a lot of people didn't know how to respond.
I think they just didn't know what to make of it, honestly. I saw a lot of reactions along the lines of like, oh, I'm actually surprised that this didn't happen earlier, because we have been seeing the violence or just the very charged and negative rhetoric coming from, you know, the quote unquote Bernie bro. And so I started seeing that too. Right. And so, you know, I don't think it was a bubble per se, but it's just like people were, that to me was a little surprising, the fact that people were saying that. And I mean, I guess it's true. I never really experienced that sort of like hatred or rhetoric that the Bernie bros were, you know, and I never really did, but I know people who did.
Right. So if you watch conservative media, which I know both of you guys are big, you know,
target demographic. Are you kidding me?
You would have seen a lot of this.
But it's part of a pattern. As you saw the one sign this guy was holding, you've had an increasing intensity of hostility on the left.
The left is responsible for the shooting because the shooter was a Bernie supporter, like you guys say. And this is after the Portland stabbings, which were carried out by a former Bernie supporter as well. And now there's a John Ossoff ad, which says the same thing, that the left encourages violence.
Liberal extremists will stop at nothing to push their radical agenda. Now they're turning their attention to Georgia and demanding that you vote for John Ossoff for Congress.
So a lot of conservative media has no problem assigning an identity to the shooter, but except the identity they pick isn't white male, it's liberal.
Going from white male to liberal to Bernie bro, you know, you can get a finer point until you finally have this somewhat troubled individual who dragged his foster daughter out of the house, you know, by her hair. You hear different stories about a troubled family life. There is a knee-jerk reaction on both the right and the left to explain away violence that's committed in their own name, and to justify it or to dismiss it and not to really face it. I think that's happening on both sides.
On both sides, I agree. I mean, it just, you know, whatever fits their narrative, they're going to rationalize it the way. And I agree with Farah that it is happening on both sides. It's just, that's what it is.
So there's nothing more. You guys are just like, this is what it is. Bernie bros.
No, but I honestly, and again,
you guys are both like
good people. Yeah. Good people I know were saying things like, I don't understand, I don't agree with what he did, but I understand it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And within a couple of minutes, someone was saying, if this guy turns out to have had a terrible medical condition, could this be described as self-defense? We have moved away from the idea that violence under no circumstances is acceptable. We really have. We have moved towards a place where people justify violence every day, and where they dehumanize the other side, and where they say the other side is not only wrong about public policy, the other side is evil, and they're out to get me, and we have to stand up and fight them. And I can't tell you how many events I've been to where the language has been like, you know, on the one side, they're like, you know, take the high road. We're gonna love Trump's hate, but we will fight you in the streets. And I mean, that's real.
Yeah,
it's real.
Like you say, it's happening on both sides. It's happening
in the talk about the play in the Shakespeare play.
Well, you're stealing my what's missing.
I stole your what's missing.
Hey, this is Nicole, Internet in the Thick. And we've got some exciting news. We'll be recording a Live in the Thick show from the Aspen Ideas Festival on Tuesday, June 27th. So if you're in Aspen, come check us out. And if you're not able to come in person, tune in on July 4th when we'll release the episode from Aspen. Follow us on social media for more details. And if you believe in what we do here at In the Thick, bringing underrepresented voices to the national conversation, go to inthethink.org, click on the donate button, and consider supporting us with a monthly gift. Thanks. And if you're a fan of In the Thick, try our sister podcast, Latino USA. This week, Latino USA breaks down the different relationships between fathers and sons, featuring our very own Julio Ricardo Varela, from an adult son who reflects back on how his dad treated him like the little prince of the house, to a teen dad whose masculinity was defined during his challenging journey to fatherhood. Subscribe to Latino USA wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, hosting solo this week while my co-host, Maria Hinojosa, is reporting from El Paso. With me is Farrah Stockman, reporter for the New York Times, and Marcela Garcia, editorial writer for the Boston Globe and co-host of the new weekend edition of WGBH's Boston Public Radio. Let's get back to the conversation. Let's talk about another situation that involved crime and shootings, and it was actually the ruling on Jerónimo Yanez, the cop who shot and killed Philando Castile.
The jury today ruled that Jerónimo Yanez is not guilty of manslaughter in the shooting death of Philando Castile.
He's the latest cop to be acquitted of shooting a black man and, you know, Mexican-American as well. Castile had a permit to carry a gun. He told him, like, this is the case, but Yanez still shot and killed him. First of all, before we talk about the gun permit, the notion of brown cop killing black victim.
That was Trayvon Martin, though. Remember?
Right, George Zimmerman.
Zimmerman, classify as Hispanic.
I will give it a little context, because with Zimmerman, one of the things that happened, I remember Bernie Goldberg, or he was a big commentator. He was talking about, this is not a white-black issue. He's Latino. But it's obvious that there's issues of brown and black here that are kind of being suppressed.
This was an act of a cop being, you know, a cop, whether he was brown, whether he was white. I just don't think that there was anything there, as far as I know, that him being Hispanic or Latino had anything to do. He was a cop. And I know Latino cops who are very good cops. I know Latino cops who are also, you know, who have this mentality of like this, an oppressive mentality, really. And so, you know, in other words, it's almost like their cop identity sort of like supersedes their, you know, their ethnic identity, in the sense that it's who they are. It's a culture of being a cop.
Here's my question for you both.
Spoken like a true New York Times journalist.
Do you believe this police officer that he was afraid?
Yes.
Yes.
So
Totally.
The question to me that I ask is whether, no matter, regardless of his race,
yes,
how much exposure has he ever had to Black people?
Exactly.
And so you can imagine even a Black police officer who hasn't had a lot of exposure to Black people who are...
It's not just the exposure. I mean, it is the culture of being a cop, too, that it's almost like they have this built-in, you know, racism against Blacks, because they would always tell you, look at the numbers, look at who they commit crimes. They really have this bias against Black people.
There was once a time where I just said... And I never wrote this, but this was when I was at the Boston Globe. I said, I wonder where these guys went to high school. And I looked up all the cops that had shot people in ridiculous circumstances. And I found their high schools. And I looked at the percentage of Black people who went to their high schools at the time. And they were minuscule. The guy who, you know, the guy who shot the in North Carolina is the guy who was running away.
Yeah.
And, you know. And I mean, it was just some of them, they were like 98% white, 97% white. I had yet to find one that went to a high school that went again. Maybe there are. I don't want to say I didn't complete my reporting.
That's fascinating.
But I'd be curious. And I would, because I remember a lot of the media at that time was focusing on the victims. I was like, no, the question is the police officers and what is their life experience? Where do they have a friend who looks like Philando Castile?
Mm-hmm. I'm still stuck on this anti-Blackness in the Latino community. And I just want to read this statement from Marisa Franco, who's a director of Mi Gente, which is a big organizing collective. And this is what she said. She said that the fear that Officer Yanez had of Philando Castile in his passenger seat is one that is taught to us and one that is prevalent in our communities, meaning the Latino community. We cannot denounce him without actively confronting Latinx anti-Blackness. It must be undone.
I totally agree with that. But that's not any different than the white community or the Asian community. I mean, I think there are bias and you know, racism issues against Blacks from all different communities. And yes, you're right. And that has its roots and history in, like, you know, centuries of
Latin American history.
Exactly.
Caste systems.
I would also say that this is a bigger issue in that we talk about the day when the United States becomes majority-minority. We talk about the day, and that is almost entirely driven by Hispanics.
Mm-hmm.
Blacks are not growing in number the way Hispanics are. And so people have this assumption that someday, because of Hispanics, America's going to be a majority-minority country. And I don't think that's a very, you know, a good portion of those people could choose that they are going to live as whites. They are not going to identify as Hispanics. And so not that much could change. And so I think sometimes maybe we overblow this idea that we're, you know, people of color are all in it together.
Bingo! And Farrah Sackman wins it. And that's the point I'm trying to make is when you talk about white supremacy, and I'm going to give credit to Terrell Starr, who's a frequent contributor of In the Thick, and he says, you know, you don't have to be white to practice white supremacy. And there's plenty of Latinos out there who are going to want to be white in terms of not necessarily from a skin color, but in sort of that, you know, I want to identify as white. But what's missing in all this is, and this is why I wanted to ask about it, is that no one talks about it this way. Look at George Zimmerman. You just see him as a white guy, but he's like half Peruvian. But the fact that the mainstream media can't even have that type of conversation, it always has to be either or, when in fact, the Latino community has its own damn issues and has its own biases and has centuries of colonial like issues that it's just not part of the conversation.
Right.
That's all I'm saying,
right.
Marcella. Whether we agree with it or not is different.
No, I actually agree. Look at what's happening with Dominicans and Haitians.
Yep.
It is the same dynamic. And so that also... it's a reflection of that dynamic. You know, it's there's Dominicans that identify as, you know, that you could define them as white supremacists too by, you know, rejecting their Haitian brothers and sisters.
This is why, though, I think that all, you know, talk the revolutionary struggle against an oppressive system should be about something broader than ethnic identity, because if we are all just, you know, it's very easy for one race to replace another, or for, you right. know, for light-skinned blacks to replace black-skinned, dark-skinned right. blacks, like you might right. have seen that in Haiti. Like, right. it's very, you know, if you're talking about making the country fairer for everybody, I mean, that includes all people who are at a huge disadvantage, and that should include, if you want the broadest possible coalition, that includes economically disadvantaged whites.
Yeah.
That, and so I just think that the liberal, you know, we've had a lot of conversations just about race, and we completely forgot how that's not the end of the story.
To go back to my original point, because now I'm going to bring the NRA in. So we talk about Philando Castile, and we talk about the fact that he had a permit, right? Mm-hmm. He had a permit to carry a gun. So this seems like the kind of thing the NRA would be all up in arms about. No pun intended. Somebody shot while legally carrying a gun. But they're silent. They're not saying anything. So do you think it's because speaking up would be anti-cop? Or is it because speaking up, it's because the person who got shot was black?
Both of them.
Marcella, so
yeah,
say more.
I think both. Main reason is because they don't want to be seen as anti-law enforcement, I think. They're one of the biggest supporters, and they're not going to come out against them. And yeah, of course, because the victim is black, you know. It's almost like, who cares?
Well, interestingly, right after the shooting, yeah. some of their members were angry that they hadn't said very much. And
some of them,
for
the organization not to speak up,
right? I mean, you could find people on Twitter saying, "What do I pay my dues for if you're not going to, you know, stand
defend,
up for
yeah.
right?" But they said back, they issued a statement saying, "We will give, you know, we'll give a more complete statement once the facts are more clear." And it's been a year now.
I mean, when
we've
seen can they
trial.
Get any clearer?
That's a
like, right,
nothing's going to change.
I mean, that's. The reality is that as long as a cop's fear for his or her life is going to be a legal justification for shooting someone, then black people in this country are not going to be able to exercise their Second Amendment rights the way other people do. And they can't. I mean, have you seen these videos of like open carry experiments? These white people who walk into airports with these guns.
In Cleveland at the RNC, and there was three or four like white dudes like walking around open carry.
Right.
And they're like, the right is up. Like, and you just wonder, right? It's like, if you switch that, would people be like, do you think like that white open carry guy, if he's like, hey, what's up?
There have been black guys
doing the same carry
who have also filmed themselves doing open carry experiments, and they have, you know,
I've seen that video. It's like it's within like 10 seconds cops show up. But if it's a white open carry guy, it's like, the guy's like, he can buy a burger and like just eat it on the road.
We have this whole legal system, which is sort of built on the idea that if a cop fears for his or her life, they are allowed to shoot. And so fear is very, subjective.
All right, so let's move on to our final segment, Mic Drop. And this is a segment where guests get to choose from a list of options for their final words. You say your piece, and then you drop the mic. So we've got five options: fantasy CNN, what's missing, tough questions, mea culpa, and side eye. So Marcela Garcia.
Oh my God, I only have to pick one?
You can do a Maria combo, because what Maria Hinojosa always like combines them. Oh. So she can be like, mea culpa, fantasy, but I kind of keep it pure, but once in a while I do a Maria combo.
So a side, big side eye, Marco Rubio, who was, you know, joined President Trump last Friday in Miami, speaking in Spanish, and like, you know, big moment for
big
Marco.
Big Cuban accent.
Yeah, big Cuban accent. He was in the middle of like, you know, Miami and the Cuban community.
We ran against each other. He won the Republican nomination. I'm a Republican. I'm not going to support Hillary Clinton. He got elected. He's the president of the United States.
I mean, I couldn't help but think of those times when they were debating and they were like butting heads, and now, you know, here they are, best friends. And of course, we had seen how Marco Rubio in one of the congressional hearings that we had, he was basically defending the president, right? Or acting as a surrogate. And so you couldn't help but wonder, you know, there's something here going on. Of course, it was the deal to dial back or reverse some of the Cuba policies enacted by the Obama administration. So it was like, you know, Marco Rubio homecoming, you know, but you look at the constituency. I mean, it's basically a bunch, like a handful of like hardliners, you know, Cuban Americans. But the clout that they have is what I think it's fascinating. And I think Trump really does credit them for their, you know, for his win in Florida. And so I think it's just huge side eye to little Marco. For doing that.
El ojito, yeah, little Marco. All right.
I mean, I don't know.
And Farrah, what do you got?
So I have the what's missing that you tried to steal from me.
I did not try to steal it. I'm teasing it. I teased it.
So just for those who weren't aware, there's a Shakespeare in the Park in New York City, and it's playing a production of Caesar, right?
Yes.
And apparently the Caesar is like Trump, and he's even in the bathtub like texting or tweeting or whatever. Allegedly, people go to watch him be assassinated. Well, that's the play.
Right.
That's the play, exactly.
And so, was it Friday night?
Over the weekend. I think it was Saturday. So it was definitely over the weekend.
This 24-year-old, she really is I won't even call her a Republican activist. She's a, she's like super on the right, and she ran up on stage right before the assassination scene and said, it is not okay.
Freedom.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to pause, security.
Stop normalizing violence against the right. And she was with Rebel Media. It's sort of like this, she's occupying this interesting space between activism and journalism. It's not journalism what she did, but she knows a lot of these people who then knew she was going to do it, and they put her message out, and now and she was arrested, and so now Free Laura is like a hashtag on Twitter. And I just think that those of us who are not in the right, far-right media space have not understood. I mean, this is the beginning of the resistance to the resistance. These are people who are, you know, see themselves as the opposite of Antifa, and they are...
I don't think people realize that 5 years ago in Minneapolis, they did Obama.
Right.
Yes. As Julius Caesar. And did the same thing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
All right. So I am going to go pure in the thick, a non-Maria combo. I'm going fantasy CNN. I have the best segment, the best show. I'm going to pitch it to them. Racist, bigoted, anti-Latino viral videos going on in 7-Elevens and all over, and Walmarts and everywhere. I don't know if you guys saw this out of Tampa over the weekend. Mm-hmm. 7-Eleven clerk, it was a Cuban family speaking Spanish, and someone, you know, he started going, are you guys legal? Show me your papers. And obviously it got
a customer or the attendant,
the clerk.
Okay.
And obviously the clerk was screaming at these people, and they're like, I'm an American citizen. Well, you should speak English. And someone, you know, recorded it. And I just think, like, there should now, like, there's, it's become an internet video genre in the Trump era, where people do it in like shopping malls and in restaurants. I know it turned into a tragic one in Houston a couple of weeks ago when there was a sheriff and her husband at some fast food place, and the guy held him in a chokehold. It was awful.
Oh my God, I remember.
Remember that,
that
one? I think Fantasy CNN could actually create a show, and
speak English or speak American?
Speak English. I want to host it. I'm going to pitch it, and hopefully.
Or don't speak Mexican.
Yeah, don't speak Mexican, or it's like, go back to America or whatever. It's so ironic. Wow. But I think
you're right. There's so many of them right now. It's a genre.
It's becoming a genre. Farrah Stockman, reporter for The New York Times, and Marcela Garcia, editorial writer for The Boston Globe and co-host of the new weekend edition of WGBH's Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining me on In the Thick.
Thank you for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. And remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. It really helps. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In The Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends. Our producer is Noam Hassenfeld. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Our intern is Nicole Acevedo. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. Some of our music is composed by Noam, and the other music you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZK Records. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening. Nos vemos.
And congrats on the solo hosting.
I did. Yeah, tell Marie I did a good job.